Hello and welcome to Bizarre Conspiracies. I completely forgot how I did the intro for a minute. We're finally back. Conrad is here.
No, it's supposed to go, I'm Eric Patino, and then I come in and I say, and I'm Conrad Tull, and then you go, and this is Bizarre Conspiracy Theories. That's how it's supposed to go.
It's been like, what, 3 months?
It does, but it feels like it's been a whole lot longer. I've really missed doing this.
It felt like a year almost. But yes, we were gone for a little while. Conrad has a good reason because he got a new job. I don't have a good reason. I was just lazy.
I apologize, but the work that I got, I was going through a training period. The training period is now over, but the people who are training me did not work well with my luggage or any of my downtime or anything like that. So the ability for me to study and do a podcast in a good form and fashion was almost nil. So,
And he's added some new words to his vocabulary.
I have not.
Let's see if they slip out. I think I've slipped up definitely a bunch of times and said certain things.
Yeah, those special four letter words.
Yeah. But this is Bizarre Conspiracies, and we are back. And today we're going to be talking about, I think it's still trending in media. I mean, it certainly hasn't slowed down at all. And that is the whole Russia and Ukraine invasion. And we're going to get Conrad's hot take on it. We did not intend for this to be the episode today. Actually, it was going to be something else. And I was like, you know what? Let's just talk about this. So it's going to be off the cuff.
Some of our best podcasts have actually just been the off the cuff ones.
Yeah.
But those have just been the ones we were most passionate about, where it's like, forget what we were planning on. I'm super passionate about this.
Yeah, that other episode is going to be crazy. Trust me, it's going to have all kinds of stuff in it that you've probably never heard in one story. But let's get down to this Ukraine thing, because Conrad told me he thinks it's for other reasons other than what Putin has said that he started this whole invasion in the first place. The whole reason that he wanted to gain control of Ukraine, it's not because neo-Nazis, right?
Well, yeah. So there's two mainstream stories. And so if I've ever learned anything about mainstream media or mainstream stories, it's almost always that the story that is told and popularized is normally what is most convenient for who's ever telling it. And they'll put their own spin on it. And it's not necessarily untrue what they say, but certain things are blown out of proportion.
Sure.
So what you'll find in this Ukraine thing is there's two mainstream stories, one from the Western countries and then one from Putin himself. If you talk to anyone in the Western media, what they say is, well, it was because Putin was trying to stop Ukraine from joining all-powerful NATO, and he was just afraid of there being another NATO country on his border, and he felt as though it was an encroachment or whatnot on his a power and his a threat to the region and unstable of the Cold War balance and that sort of a thing. So he felt he was afraid and intimidated by the Western powers, and so he had to invade to maintain stability over the region. So
do you remember when Russia attacked Ukraine? I think it was back in 2014.
I do. Actually, it is considered still part of the same conflict. Current?
Okay. I was going to ask, what was their reasoning back then?
Okay. That one is when he took over Crimea only. And actually, this plays into one of the few theories, what I call the true reason. And this one actually plays most into the one that I'm most convinced of. Should I go ahead and spill the beans?
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Russia is what they call a petrol state, which means it runs on the exportation of natural or fossil fuels. Now, I don't know if exactly natural gas is considered petroleum product, but they call it a petrol state because it's a fossil fuel. A few years prior, I think it actually was almost at the turn of the millennium, like in 2002, it was discovered in Ukraine and in the surrounding areas underneath the waters of Crimea, large pockets of natural gas deposits, massive amounts of gas. And Russia being that being one of their main exports, it makes up something like 30% of the Russian government finance is fossil fuels, which is why you hear so much about the Russian-Germany pipeline, right? Is because, and you know, Russia's control over natural gas into Europe, which is one of the reasons why the Russians invaded Ukraine during the winter, because they invaded in February, right?
I believe so.
And no, wait a minute. It was still April. What am I saying? It hasn't been that long. it was either late March or early April. It was still very cold in Europe. And I think the Russian idea was that Germany and a bunch of the other countries that were dependent on them for fuel could not afford to cut ties with Russia and say, we will not buy your natural gas, because if they did, then they wouldn't have natural gas to fuel their homes, and a lot of their civilians would be in danger of freezing to death. So that's why Russia did their whole invasion in the cold month. But now it's warming up, so that you could see if for next winter the European countries all find a different source for their winter fuel, they could just stop buying Russian natural gas entirely over the summer, and then they would be fine for the next winter as well. But so why is this all important to their invasion of Crimea and later Ukraine? Is because originally, way back in when these deposits were first found, Ukraine did not have the money in order to buy the massive amount of machinery and industry able to tap down into the underwater pockets around Crimea, and then also the deep reserves that are in mainland Ukraine in order to extract the natural gas. So they were not a competitor to Russia's massive amount of income in being a petrol state of natural gas. However, just recently, I think it was like the year before they invaded Crimea, ExxonMobil struck a deal with Ukraine International, a deal that they could extract the natural gas if they built offshore platforms around Crimea. They would have the rights to drill and extract the resources, but they had to build it and finance it themselves. Where Ukraine did not have the resources to do it, ExxonMobil certainly does. The Exxon or the ExxonMobil?
ExxonMobil. Just Exxon?
Anyway, so Exxon was planning on going in and doing this whole extraction, and then Exxon would become perhaps a larger export of natural gas than Russia. And, you know, Ukraine would get money from this as well as part of the deal with Exxon. So just the year after that, Russia in 2014 invades and takes Crimea. And according to natural law, not natural law, international law, there we go. A country has, they possess the waters surrounding the land out to, I think it's 14 miles, is it, from the place they capture, the land that they possess. You have, like, after a while, you have the international border of the water ends, and then it's international water. But I think it was like 70% of all the natural gas that was found in that survey lied inside Crimea and that Crimean water border. So when Russia took that, they took that majority of that entire area that Exxon was going to extract and mine from. So that prevented the short-term risk of Exxon setting up offshore mining things and drilling down and extracting that natural gas and becoming a direct competitor. But they still feared, they're still, because I think what they found is that Ukraine was sitting on like the sixth largest reserve of natural gas in the world. So 30% of the sixth largest natural gas reserve is still massive. I don't remember exactly who the other ones are. I think one of them is the U.S. Another is, I don't know if it'd be Saudi Arabia. Another is Mexico. Another is Venezuela. I don't remember all of them. Mm-hmm. And then one of them would be Russia. I think that's five, right? Have I named five?
I'm going to say yes.
And then Russia, and then Ukraine would be number six after that. That part that still remained in Ukraine is still a significant portion. And that the place that the new offensive the Russians have been launching to the eastern Donbass region includes almost the majority of the rest of the natural gas.
So Russia started all this because they wanted to control more of the oil?
Not oil, natural gas. It'd be an actual gas, not a liquid.
So they wouldn't be competing against ExxonMobil.
Right.
But why wouldn't they just come out and say that they're
taking the resources?
That they want the resources, not because everyone in Ukraine or Crimea is neo-Nazis.
Well, the only people that they want to fool, the absolute only people that they're trying to do fool with their hokey pokey dance and smoke and mirror is not the international world. It's not Ukraine itself. It is not themselves, as in like the officials or the military. The people that they're trying to fool is the civilians of Ukraine. Not Ukraine, Russia. The civilians of Russia. If you go to the regular Russian citizen right now and you ask them, why are we fighting this war? They're the people that Putin needs to be backed by. He needs their support. So that's what the story about neo-Nazis is. So if you listen to when Putin was first announcing the invasion or the special operation of the Ukraine invasion to the Russian people, he includes NATO as one of the reasons that he is doing this to protect the safety of Russia. Okay. He also says that says that it is the Russian speaking civilians pretty much inside of Ukraine, and how these people who are in Russian and all but name are being kept in a different country, and so he needs to take over parts of Ukraine in order to bring these true Russians back into Russia. And he also states that Russia spent tons of money in the Soviet era building infrastructure in Ukraine. Things like the massive amount of money that was spent building the Chernobyl sarcophagus and all the amount of investment that they put into Ukraine, and how Ukraine owes them as another reason. So those were like the three things that he concentrated on most in his justification of his special operation in Ukraine.
Did you think Ukraine was going to put up a fight like they did?
No, I was entirely shocked. Like,
right?
I expected it that the second weekend after I heard that there was, before the Russia invaded, intelligence agencies must have told the United States group of leaders. I don't know exactly who or how high up, but I know at least Biden knew that Russia was going to invade Ukraine, because at one point, he had massed all the troops on the Ukrainian border as a training exercise, he said. Then a few weeks after the end of the training exercise was supposed to end, the Russian troops were still there. And Joe Biden said that he would meet with Putin on the condition that Putin had not already invaded Ukraine at that point. Then a few days later, before the meeting ever took place, Russia invaded Ukraine and the meeting was called off because the meeting was predicated on the idea that Putin had not invaded Ukraine. So that tells me before the invasion ever happened, Joe Biden knew that the invasion was pending, or else he wouldn't have put that stipulation on the meeting. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So when I heard that Joe Biden put that stipulation down in the meeting, I knew that the invasion was coming. And I, at that moment, said, I don't think Ukraine is going to last more than 2 weeks. Because I was like a lot of other people. I grown up hearing of the Cold War and America being the mortal sworn enemy against Russia. And all those analysts on YouTube saying, well, what would have happened if the Cold War had actually started fighting, not counting nukes? What would happen between the United States military and the Russian military? And like, this is what it'd play out to. And then, you know, it could go this way. And then by week four, it would look like this. And so I always had this idea of Russia being an equal to the United States military.
Sure, in force.
And I was in for a shock to see that it lasted as long as it is. And it's kind of shocking, but at the same time, it's not shocking. Because if you look at Russian history, Russia invaded Finland in, I think it was 1934, 35, in the Finnish Winter War.
It was a while ago.
And it was a total raffle stomp, where the Russians humiliated themselves on the world stage. And then there was the Russian-Japanese War that happened even before that. Actually, I think that happened before World War One. And the Japanese defeated the Russians severely around the Korean Peninsula. I think it was Port Arthur that the main battle happened, and it was like there was a massive naval battle, and the Japanese sank a lot of Russian ships, and then they destroyed a lot of Russian equipment, and they also killed a lot of Russians. And then there was the beginning of World War II, where Russia did not do well when they invaded Poland. If you remember, at the beginning of World War II, Russia invaded Poland from the east, and Germany invaded Poland from the west in a military pack. But if you look at who covered the most ground, you can see that the German Blitz conquered 3/4 of Poland, while the Russian invasion only made it 1/4 of the way. So that means that the German army was moving at like 4 times the speed of the Russian military.
So why is there this perception that the Russian army is just as good as ours?
I don't know really exactly, but I think it has to do with the later half of World War II, when Russia eventually did defeat the Nazi invasion and pushed back all of the German forces and conquered the eastern half of Europe. I mean, it took the Russians a while, and if you look at the casualties, it's like 10 million Russians died. Jeez. In World War II. If the casualties of the Russians to the Germans was like a 2-to-1 over the entire war. And normally, when you win a war, you lose less than the enemy does. Mm-hmm. You look at the American losses compared to the Japanese losses in World War II, you go, wow, the Japanese lost so many more than the Americans. If you look at the English losses to the Italians, you go, wow, the Italians lost more in those battles that they fought with the British. And, you know, so normally the victor has less losses than the victor. No, wait, the victor has more losses than the loser. And the reason for that is, at the beginning, of the war, when you have equal size, equal amounts of stuff, generally the better prepared army, you know, kills more of the enemy, and then that's why they're the winner. But that's not how the Russians roll. They lose more than everybody in a war. They pay in blood, and it's because they just don't seem to be very good at winning wars. But they have a lot of soldiers, and they have a lot of armor, and they have a lot of tanks, and they have a lot of stuff. On paper, they look powerful, but they're not. We could do a whole rest of the podcast on why the Russians look strong but are actually weak. But I would say it's a few different things, a few key things. One, loyalty is promoted to positions of power over competency. So a fellow like Stalin or Vladimir Putin will pick a leader to be the commander of the armed forces, not because they're good at their job, but because they're loyal. So you'll have incompetent, loyal people. Two, there'll be corruption, obviously. And three, it'll be this in a communist dictatorship, bad news and feedback tends to be worse than in other groups because everybody likes to tell their boss that things are going well, right?
Sure.
Nobody wants to be like, hey, boss, we're running behind schedule and over budget. So there'll be, in most businesses, a tend to go, that things kind of land on the boss's desk at the last possible moment where you like try to fix problems and you kind of push things under the rug that shouldn't be pushed under the rug and should be brought up to higher management sooner. I mean, that's a tendency.
Mm-hmm.
In a communist country where you kill people for failure, things get pushed under the rug a whole lot more than they should. So that problem is really exacerbated. So you'll see things where people will be like, yeah, in fact, boss, we are not behind schedule. We're actually ahead of schedule and under budget. We're doing great. Things are better than possibly expected. Please don't cut my head off. So what happens is the first level of management gets a pretty picture painted for them. So then they go to their next level of management and they paint the picture up even prettier than the group before them. And then you have this sweeping effect where it gets to the top and the guys at the very top are looking, wow, things are going great. But down at the bottom, things are rusting. Things are not being properly maintained. People aren't properly trained. Things are actually working very poorly, but people never figure it out and there's not the proper response to it. So that mixed with corruption leads to things not working like they should. Soldiers not knowing how to operate their equipment. You know, training not being done. People don't know how to take orders. Things are not clear. Communications are bad.
So we definitely shouldn't be fearing the Russian army.
So, I mean, and that's what's plagued the Russian army all the way back in the very beginning. If you look at even the battle of between the Japanese and the Russians, the Japanese military were the first ones to use machine guns, not as artillery pieces that fire from the back row and shoot at faraway targets and try and pin down enemies, but were first used up close. So this was before World War I, as a frontline weapon where you would use it to deliberately strike tons of damage straight into clumps of infantry as opposed to being a suppression like artillery shelling barrage where you shoot at tons of bullets from far away and you're just raining them down in a general area. So they were the first ones to use where you would see machine gun fire cutting down ranks of soldiers like you were used to thinking of World War I combat. But the Russian army did not respond to this effectively because so they ended up throwing tons of waves of soldiers into combat because the people who were failing on the battlefield were not saying, hey, we are really outclassed here. We did not do any damage to the enemy's line when we attacked last time. They'd be like, yeah, we did okay. We, better. You know, we hurt them a little bit. Yeah. They're, you know, kind of hanging on there by a thread. I think we could have almost had them there. But, we got repulsed. And so they go, oh, so they're close to breaking. Well, I mean, yeah, you could say that. Okay, we'll send in another one. Well, okay.
Let's just drink all this vodka before we do that.
So that really hurt them. And then the Finnish war, what they found is the armor, very similar to the current war, is the armor got separated from the infantry very easily. And armor unsupported by infantry and ground troops are easily taken out. So what you found that the Finnish did is they deliberately left holes inside of their anti-tank wall. So they had like concrete barriers that would stop tanks. They left holes in them. So the tanks that are charging across the field towards their line could seemingly do what their training says to do, which is to break through the enemy lines and flank them and blitz them. So they break through what they think is a gap in the enemy line. But what they turn out to be is when they break through that line, they've actually entered a killing zone where they're then surrounded on all sides. They run into a second wall behind that where they can't continue moving forward. And then they're surrounded on either side and they can't back out because it's a choke point. Where they thought they were breaking through the enemy line, it's just that the enemy line wasn't shooting at them and letting them get through their line, and now they're surrounded on all sides. And they've outrun their infantry, and so now they're isolated behind enemy lines in a pocket of anti-tank weapons without infantry support, and they lost a lot that way.
So, God, I love the finish.
It's very similar to what's going on now, I think, Well, I don't actually know that. The war that's going on in Ukraine is... You hear a lot of stuff that's going on, but you can't really know what you're hearing is true or not. But apparently, tanks have not been appropriately trained to work with infantry, and sometimes they're getting isolated and destroyed. Is that what's happening the majority of the time? I don't know. But I do know that that has happened occasionally because I saw like one or two videos of one or two tanks being isolated and destroyed. Is that the big picture? No, that's a tiny little snippet. It's not the whole story. It may or may not represent the majority of Russian losses, you know?
Well, there's an article from just 2 hours ago saying Ukraine said that it sank two Russian naval vessels in the Black Sea. Happened on Monday. Yeah, it happened today, Monday. Interesting.
So that two new ones, or that like their total? So is that adding to the Moskva, or is that just two new ships that they sank?
I think that's two new ships because it's from today.
Okay. Well, that's interesting because they withdrew their ships when the Moskva sunk. What they did is they drew their ships back further to try and get them out of missile range. If they're still losing ships, that could be an indication that orders were being broke, people got careless, or the Ukrainians figured out a way to move their missiles further into the ocean, which, you know, that would be interesting, a portable, large surface to water missile. I don't know exactly how you do that. Put that on a speedboat, massive rocket launcher on a speedboat, run that out a couple miles into the sea.
No clue.
But, you know, necessity is the mother of invention, and war is the utmost pit of necessity. So you find some of the most inventive stuff comes from wars.
All right, so we are actually... Like
the secret reason why Russia is invading Ukraine.
Well, hold on, Conrad. We're going to take a quick break.
Alrighty.
So, we're going to take a quick break and then we'll come right back.
Yeah, to finish up I guess I'll finish my theory after the break of why it is that they're being invaded. And then I have a bonus theory on top of that.
Ooh, okay. Bigfoot?
No. And then, of course, we'll cover why it isn't neo-Nazis as well. after the break.
Good stuff. Don't go anywhere. And we're back from the break. We took actually a long break there.
But I don't think that the audience, that necessarily shows up to the audience because of editing. The magic of editing! Wah, wah, wah!
No, it's been 5 seconds? And poof, here we are again. So, yeah. But take us through the final conclusions here, Conrad.
So, we talked about the Russians needing natural gas. And to finish it out, what my main theory is, the reason that they invaded Ukraine, is they wanted to take over all of Ukraine, install a puppet dictator, and then withdraw and leave behind a puppet. And then this puppet would never contest them in the petroleum state era. So they would maintain their Russian power because the Russian military has not been doing well, as we can tell. They've been underfunded. A lot of their weakness is not due to them not having good technology and not having enough tanks, but it's just them not having enough money to do proper maintenance. Mm-hmm. It's a maintenance and training issue. So they can have all these tanks to project power. They just can't ever use them because they don't work. So they have the initial cost of all of these equipments, like the Moskva and all these expensive their aircraft carrier and all of this. Sure. But they sit around and they rust because they don't have this money. And now they're being threatened with losing their petrol money, and they're really looking at losing Russia being a player in the world stage. So it's kind of like a last stand thing of, hey, we've got to hang on to this money as long as we can. So it's actually kind of like the death throes, my theory, of the Russian Federation being a world power.
Mm.
So they're doing this thing to try and hold on to as much money as they can. And if they lose this new offensive that's happening in the east of Ukraine, if they do not make this, I would call this their last real push. If they do not make this successful push, my prediction, they will lose the protracted battle, the protracted war. This is like the last bit of their war. And if they lose the war, then they lose their funding. If they lose their funding, because they will lose the president.
They lose everything.
I mean, it's not looking good for them.
Do you think they will win in the end?
I do not think they will.
I'm kind of thinking Ukraine is going to hold to the very end.
Yeah, I think that they will not win. I think they will lose what they took over in 2014, the Crimean Peninsula.
Oh, okay.
And they will ultimately have to accept Ukraine's independence and their control over those regions. And that will signal the end of the Russian era, just as what war was it that signaled the end of the United Kingdom's power? There'll be that moment, a watershed moment, where people will stop looking at them as a world player, just like that the British Empire was seen as this main force back in World War II. But after World War II and later on in the Cold War, people have stopped seeing them as a main player. Anyway, mm-hmm. So Putin says that there is the neo-Nazis in Ukraine that he's trying to stomp out. To put a kind of an end to this myth, yeah, there are neo-Nazis in Ukraine, and they've been there for a while. They're the still old remnants, actually, of the Third Reich.
I think even Ukraine came out and said, yeah, but we're not doing anything.
So a lot of people pay attention to the Azov battalion, right? And they say that the neo-Nazis who have committed war crimes, right? Well, I don't know if you... let me ask you this opinion. When somebody says that somebody's committed war crimes, does that, like international war crimes, does that to you... are you like, oh my gosh, how terrible, that's awful? Or are you more like, kind of, it doesn't really have the same impact as if somebody's like, yeah, this guy's a murderer, or if you say this guy's a war criminal? Like, which one really? Because people call like George Bush a war criminal, right?
Sure, I've heard that before.
So war criminal is kind of one of those overused things where you're like, I don't really know if this is like something I should really care about. And the reason for that is the Azov battalion. I went and did some research on this. The Azov battalion, their war crimes are looting civilian homes. Mm-hmm. So kind of like burglary.
Sure.
And one incident where they, one incident of gang rape. So like there is a person with an actual name. It's not like a statistic of like 500 people were gang raped by the Azov battalion. It was like this one particular person. was gang raped by the Azov battalion, and they tortured enemy soldiers, and they extracted information under duress out of enemy soldiers. So those are their three war crimes. So burglary is not really what most people are like, oh my God, that's horrible. It's like, yeah, that's not good. One case of gang rape, although that is horrible, abhorrent, and I think that those Azov battalion members should go to jail and maybe never see the light of day again. It does not necessarily condemn the whole battalion to criminal activity. You know what I'm saying? It's a little different right. when you look at Russian war crimes and go, huh, there's whole villages that have been tied up, found in the ditch, shot with their hands behind their back. Like, there's a difference where you have like mass war crimes and one actual evidence, thing of evidence. Still, I'm not condoning actions which was taken. I think it's a horrible crime, but I do not think that that is necessarily something where you can go by and say the whole Azov battalion is neo-Nazi war criminals that are abhorrent. And then torturing enemy prisoners for knowledge, which is used later for effective combat. That is like a gray zone.
I mean, every country does that.
Every country does that. So it kind of really lessens the impact of calling them war criminals, where you're like, yeah.
I mean,
everybody's hell. Done that since. It's like,
even just the FBI, CIA, they all do it on their own.
Yeah.
So
I waterboarding's an own thing. But I think it was more the waterboarding. It was like breaking arms and pulling teeth.
Do you think so? Do you think all that what they're saying is a war crime is a good enough reason to invade? Let's just say that was the real reason. Do you think that's still a good reason?
No, 100% not.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
But then to add the next layer, it's hypocrisy, because there is a Russian group of privateers. What do they call mercenaries these days? Private military corporation, right? PMCs.
I have no idea.
That's what they call mercenaries these days. There's a Russian military group called the Wagner Group. Pretty famous. They've been made famous by this Ukraine thing. The Wagner Group. Wagner is the name that the owner and the founder of the Wagner Association did. He was a former Russian Spetsnaz, which is the Russian Special Forces soldier, who retired, started his own mercenary group where he trained and is well known for its efficiency. And he called it the Wagner Group after the name of a composer by the last name Wagner, but we would pronounce it Wagner because the man is a German composer. Okay. And Wagner was the famous composer that Hitler loved. And so Wagner's music, even though Wagner, the old classical composer, died long before the Third Reich ever happened, his music is associated with the Third Reich because the Third Reich loved his music so much. It was seen as like the superior German Aryan supremacy music. Like Wagner, you know, he was the pinnacle of humanity, and this is the, you know what I'm saying, the Nazis
put his music on pedestal. I know what you're saying,
The guy who made the Wagner Russian mercenary group kind of likes Nazis. He has Nazi tattoos, and he likes the Nazi music, and he kind of likes it so much that he named his entire Russian mercenary group after the famous composer who is now associated with neo-Nazis, and his music, a lot of they call it bird whistles, where a neo-Nazi will play Wagner's music, and it would be like a dog whistle for, hey fellow neo-Nazis, this is the neo-Nazi spot because we have neo-Nazi background music anyway. So it is very hard to say that you're invading a country because of a few neo-Nazi military group when you have a kind of neo-Nazi military group. It's kind of like the very, very obvious hypocrisy. So
wow.
I don't believe either story that the Putin invaded Ukraine because they could have joined NATO, or two, because they had neo-Nazis. They could the one that I don't believe they were joining NATO is because even before the invasion happened, Ukrainian officials came out and said the ability for them to join NATO has fallen apart. It is not going to be something that they will be doing in the future. Then later on in the war, Zelensky said that he promises that he will never join NATO. Mm. So it kind of, it's one of those things where it's like, yeah, it's obvious that they're not going to join NATO, because in order to join NATO, the NATO members must accept you. And several members of NATO have said they will not accept Ukraine, which is why the Ukrainians said their ability to join NATO is not possible. So the Russians know that Ukraine is not going to ever join NATO, and yet they invaded anyway. They have neo-Nazis in their own army, and yet they invaded anyway. Kind of is pointing towards natural gas. But I also mentioned that there is a secret special bonus.
Yes, yes.
Call it a Conrad special conspiracy. Why the Russians really invaded Ukraine.
Try to bust Bigfoot out of jail?
No.
Darn.
Back, this is a vampire related one.
Ooh, okay, go on.
So if you remember a few months back, we did a podcast on Rasputin, right? And I made the assertion that Rasputin is a vampire. Where are vampires originally from? Count Dracula, right? Is like the considered the first one. Where do you find Dracula is typically associated, if I'm not mistaken, they say it's Vlad the Impaler, right?
Right.
Transylvania is forget exactly where, but so the it kind of goes back to this so the place where Vlad the Impaler's coffin, not like his actual coffin, not the place he's buried now, but like his supposed because like a vampire has his coffin, right? That's like an important thing.
Sure.
Vlad the Impaler kept his coffin, like his actual coffin, not the coffin that he would have to bury a vampire in to kill. Anyway,
his bed. Yeah, we get it.
Was hidden in, I forget the chapel, but it's not in Ukraine. But my theory is there was a cult that have taken that this art, this ancient vampire. Okay, I'm getting ahead of myself because I have to connect this to the Russian, what do you call it? The Russian monarchs. I also made the assertion they themselves are vampires. And I made the connection because we know the three kings of that ruled, or was the four kings that ruled Europe, the children of Queen Victoria, that they all had vampiric ties. It's a I'm trying to cram too much in. So we know that the Russians do not like the monarchs. The old czars were overthrown, and the communists came in and drove them out. These vampires. The cult that followed Rasputin to preserve the old traditions of the vampiric things took the relics of the past and fled to Ukraine during the fall of the Soviet Union. And Vladimir Putin is getting them back to destroy them. So my theory would be, in short, he's invading Ukraine so he can find ancient artifacts and destroy vampires.
Interesting. I never took Putin as a vampire hunter.
Ah.
I like it. I like it. Remember, folks, you only get these wild conspiracy theories here with Conrad.
Yeah. I wanted to go a little more into this, and because there's a fella in that was like part, because Rasputin had a large following, and there was a fella in there, and I don't remember his name. I didn't quite have the notes, but I guess we kind of wanted to make this podcast urgently, because who knows what's going to happen in the Ukraine war, and we wanted to make it before things climacted. But maybe a continuation of this.
Yeah, we can definitely talk about it again.
But yeah, I'm going to have to flesh this out to see if it pans out. I may actually have to come back and go, well, actually, I thought this, but never mind. But
what if?
Yeah.
What if D.B. Cooper is alive, but he was in prison.
Wasn't it 70? Oh, that makes so much sense. That's why he hasn't spent the money. Because he's been in jail the whole time, separated from his...
Yeah, he's been imprisoned in Ukraine, and Putin found out about it and was like, yo, I'm going to bust my homie out.
Because he needs the money.
Right. Yeah, I've got to go. So, thank you all for listening to Bizarre Conspiracies. Actually, you know, I do remember one thing. Conrad, final thoughts.
Final thoughts. I mean, if you're going to invade a country, don't be the king of, the ancient story of the king who went to the oracles of Greece and said, what would happen if I was to invade,
talking about Persia. The Spartans?
No. This was not the Spartans. This fella went and asked, what would happen if I invaded Persia? And the oracle said, if you invaded Persia, a mighty empire would be destroyed. And he said, that is Persia will be destroyed. So he invaded, and then his country was counter-invaded and destroyed. And it was actually his country, which he did not consider great, was the great country that was destroyed, because he never stopped to consider that he had a great country. And he was not satisfied with the greatness of his country. So my final thoughts are, if you're going to invade a country, be sure that you're going to win. It's kind of like the guy in The Princess Bride who's going through this whole trouble of marrying a woman so he can kill her, so the public will be upset, so they will demand that they go to war so he could win. If you're going to go through all this trouble just so you can invade a country and all of that, you better darn sure be sure that you're going to win the war, because else you're just going to look stupid. And you know, you can't be looking stupid. That would just... Also, a lot of people would die. But you would just, most importantly, would look stupid. Anyway, that's my final thoughts on the matter.
All right. Well, it's been good being back.
Yeah.
And,
We will definitely be not stopping. We're coming back with a vengeance. And with this new job that I have, it'll have enough downtime, but I'll be able to now study and be a regular. So,
yes.
Did I mention that my new job has flexible hours, Eric?
I've kind of assumed.
Yeah, that is awesome. I have never had a job with flexible hours before. Used to, we've always been like, well, when we're going to record this podcast, let's see where schedules meet up. Now, I am free.
Yeah, we're going to be doing a lot more. And I even got a brand new cult to investigate. And Conrad loves his cults.
I sure do.
Yeah.
I actually did a brush up on cults recently. You're like, hey, exactly what's the difference between Mormons and Jehovah's Witness? Oh, I remember now. I am committing the 6 pillars of a cult to paper. So that way I will have this reference to go back to, and we will see this new cult, whether or not it meets all the 6 pillars.
Yes.
Remember, a cult does not have to get the 6 cult, the 6 pillars of cultism in order to be a cult. It just needs to meet like 4.
Yeah.
Not all cults have everything, and not everything that has the pillar is a cult, but if it walks like a duck too much and it quacks like a duck too much, it's a duck.
Well, this one is definitely a duck.
It's a quacky one, you're saying.
Oh, yes.
I can't wait.
All right. Alrighty. Well, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you in the next episode.
Alrighty.